seen SJR 7, do you feel that that kind of simple approach is better, or one that's more detailed in terms of labor agreements, share of the state, et cetera, makes more sense?
Let's back up a minute.
The first question of why you think, or do you think, that the state should be at the table?
Yeah, let me comment on that. Chevron's a multinational corporation, and I guess there's a joke about a corporation having no soul to damn and no backside to kick. But let me say this, that I guess our view would be that in an important land management situation such as this, where the state has so much at stake that it really doesn't make much sense for the state not to participate in that process, to review how it's going along, to comment on the stipulations. This is something that has a lot of significance to the economic well-being of this state and the nation. And I don't see much to be gained by pulling away from the table, so to speak, and not being part of it. And I see a lot of things that could be gained by the state participating in this process and being up to speed on it. The second question, I guess I'd echo many of Judy Meiniger's comments, which I thought were very well put. I think a resolution, among other things, has to be fairly straightforward and unequivocal and very positive. I don't think the state of Alaska, and again, you're not going to find Chevron taking sides in this because we're pretty colorblind to landowners and that sort of thing. We like to have the opportunity to explore, but it seems to me that the state would be perfectly in line in making its feelings known and concern known with fair revenue sharing, adequate protection, and so forth. But I think above all else, you don't want to put so many of those things on and burden this resolution with so much baggage that it becomes unclear what the state's position is. And I really believe that we've got an awful battle on our hands, and if we get to fighting among ourselves about land exchanges, what do we mean by local hire, what's fair revenue sharing, and that sort of thing, we're really going to wind up in a divisive sort of way, potentially, and be perceived as fighting among ourselves, when I think really there are strong arguments for everyone to have this opened.
Anyone else have any questions of Mr. Cook? I want to thank you, Tom, for helping us in our struggle as we go down the line, and I appreciate that you have a certain amount of stuff that's confidential in nature, and I know that you're fairly familiar with the area because at one time, weren't you in state government also?
Yes, I worked for a short period in the late 70s for the state. Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
So you have a broad knowledge both from both sectors of the...
Well, I'd like to compliment the committee on these hearings. I think you've developed a tremendous amount of testimony that would never have the opportunity to be brought out, and I doubt that the Congress will get into the kind of detail that you folks have, and we'll all be looking for your report.
Thank you, sir. Very much, Tom. What's the pleasure of the committee? Do we want to... How about Mr. Doble? You want to come forward? John, we'll see if there's any questions. We know that you're not prepared to make a big presentation, but maybe if... there might be some comments that you want to make on some of the presentations that were made today or positions that were made and where we're trying to get this committee and the time elements that we're now constrained with, stuff like that. And by the way, welcome back to the state. Last time I seen you, you were heading to Washington.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. You might introduce some people, just come in just so they'll know who's talking up here and what view he brings.
Okay, we have another class. This is Allwald's class that's coming in here, and that we just for the benefit of the class, while we just had a presentation by Chevron USA Inc. On their position industry, and now we have Mr. Doble, who is with the Interior Department, and we're going to. He does not have a or maybe you do, John, by now have some sort of a presentation, or you might want to make a comment or two on anything that you've heard here compared to the other presentations, because you've been to every one of our hearings. John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here again today to speak to you. This is my fourth appearance, I think, before this committee, and each one I found to be very interesting and helpful, and I think I would again like to compliment the committee on your perseverance and patience in pursuing these hearings, because I think it's been very helpful not only to the subcommittee, but I think to the public in general. I thought it might be helpful, and I don't have any prepared testimony, but I thought it might be helpful to review for you the progress on the negotiations, because I think that's foremost in many folks' minds at this point in terms of where we are. The last time I met with you was, I believe, on the 20th, if I'm not mistaken. I left for Washington the morning of the 21st and spent a little over a week back there. We participated in breakout negotiations with the five native corporation entities who were involved in the negotiations, and we had one group session. I think it's fair to characterize our progress as substantial during that period. I personally feel like we're very close to agreement in principle with three out of the five native entities. We have, in essence, reached agreement in principle with two of the native corporations on the values of their inholdings, two out of the five. So with three out of the five, we're very close to agreement in principle in terms of the contract. With two out of five, we have reached agreement on the value of the inholding of their inholdings being offered in exchange. And I think we're very close with all five in terms of the tract identification process and how we would proceed with that. As was mentioned by other folks testifying this morning, we will be meeting, as I know it at this point, the week of the 11th of May to continue to pursue negotiations. And again, I think we're hopeful that we might bring those to a closure in terms of agreement on those three areas. And I might reiterate very briefly what those are. That's the terms of the contract or the exchange agreement themselves, the value of the inholdings that are being brought to the negotiating table, and the ground rules for the tract identification process. Once we have agreement on those three issues, then we will schedule a tract identification date, if you will, and move forward with that. And I would think that we would be looking at a minimum of 30 days past the time that we would arrive at agreement on those three areas. So, you know, hypothetically, one could say that it's a possibility that we might be into tract identification sometime in June, under a best-case scenario, for successful this next round of negotiations. There were two or three points made this morning that I might want to offer a little clarification on. One, and I'll just kind of take these in the order that they came up. I jotted down a few notes.
John, maybe before we get into if there's any questions that the committee might have on your opening, you know.
Certainly.
I have one that I think that it would probably be clearer in the minds, although we've been around this barn a couple times, is that what do you see the procedure? You see the secretary sending his report, and then you see the Congress legislation being introduced. I understand that there's two or three pieces, and there'll probably be one more. Then you would go in June, then the private sector would take it back to their shareholders, then it would go back to the Interior, and then it would be on hold until Congress acted. Is that kind of the way this thing works?
Senator Coghill, that's roughly the scenario that we've built. One point that I think that needs to be made is when the final 1002H report is distributed, and that is in the near future here, that does not constitute in and of itself the Secretary's recommendation to Congress. There is a waiting period after that report is finalized, and I think right now it's 30 days, if I'm not mistaken, that has to occur before the Secretary transmits the record of decision to Congress. So if the report comes out toward the end of this month, there would be maybe as much as 30 days before the Secretary's what's referred to as the record of decision is passed to Congress. So the distribution of the final report does not represent, at least from a legal perspective, the Secretary's recommendation to Congress. That comes in another form, perhaps as much as 30 days past the date of distribution of the final report. But anyway, the final report, let's assume that it's out before the end of the month. There is the 30-day wait period. The Secretary's recommendation in the form of a record of decision goes to Congress. In the meantime, we're continuing to negotiate with the Native corporations. Let's assume for the moment that we are successful the next time we get together and we have agreement in principle on these three areas. Then we would move into tract identification potentially sometime in June, let's say. At the point at which we identify tracts, there is a 10-day, at least as the way the ground rules read now, there is a 10-day grace period within which the Native corporations have an option, or they actually are able to examine what it is they've selected to decide whether they want to move forward or not, and that was alluded to by some of the corporate testifiers here this morning. After that 10-day period is up, then if they decided to move forward, they would go forward with a proxy to their shareholders, or and it varies with the various Native corporations, and they would move toward shareholder ratification if that's what it took. At the same time, and this did not come up this morning, it's our intention to move into the public arena with the land exchanges, and there is a proposal under active consideration right now in Washington, and I expect a decision shortly on that in terms of what form that's going to take, the time frames for it, and this sort of thing. And we will see some form of public review of the proposals that are moving forward, but obviously we're not in a position to represent those to the public until we've gone through the tract identification, and the Native corporations and ourselves, for that matter, said yes, we're ready to proceed based on all the ingredients that are that make up the exchange.
What's the purpose of that, John? Is the purpose of that going public on that is that to help Congress make up their mind, or do you do this through an authority that you have already within the land program?
Senator Coghill, as a matter of policy, we generally take these kinds of major issues and major decisions to the public, and I think you see that almost on a weekly basis here in the state. I'm not, at this point, I think it'd simply be a matter of policy that we would proceed to do that, and I think good policy that we would do that. At a minimum, I think we would expect some formal presentation to the public, and that could come in a variety of ways, in which we would try to walk the general public through this thing and try to explain what it is we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish and how we've gone about doing it. And I would expect there would be some opportunity then for the public to comment on what it is that we represent. And my further expectation, although some of these decisions have not been made yet, would be that that any comment that we would receive would be made part of the administrative record and would be part of the Secretary's deliberative package when the Secretary makes a final decision to move forward, because I think, again, it's important to recognize that the Secretary to this point has not been privy to what it is we're proposing to do because of the isolation and the segregation of the 1002 process and his recommendation from the exchanges that are being proposed, and in fact, the Secretary would not be presented with the administrative record upon which he would make a decision until after we had gone through the public review process. Once we had gone through the public review process, we would then move within the department to complete the administrative record. We would make a recommendation to the Secretary based on that. He would review that information and decide up or down, go or no go. And at the same time, we're hopeful that the Native corporations would be in the same position, go or no go. We would the Secretary would sign, and the Native corporations would sign. And this would be a series of, in this case, potentially five agreements. At that point, they would simply be executed agreements, absent any authority to implement them because of the call that was made that we would seek congressional review and approval. One other point that I think might be important to make here is that we, from the standpoint of our assessment of our legal authorities, believe that we have the administrative authority to consummate these exchanges absent congressional authority. The problem is, though, we have the authority to pursue the conveyance of the land, but we don't have any authority to assure any enjoyment of those lands beyond their actual conveyance to the Native corporations, absent congressional action. And because of the complexity and some of the concerns about the potential legal implications of this, we are moving forward to Congress. But I think it's important to recognize that that was a call that was a matter of policy and not because of a legal concern about the Secretary's authority to enter into these conveyances.
Senator Jones.
Well, that kind of ties in with the question I have, Mr. Chairman. So we heard this morning from the village corporations and regional corporations that they felt that the bill that comes out of Congress will have both the as an ingredient the opening and address the land exchanges. Now, I understand from you that maybe we don't, that was, it's not entirely necessary to have the land exchanges in the bill, that it can be performed administratively. Is that right? Land exchange can go ahead without a bill?
Senator Jones, yes, that would be theoretically possible.
All right. In Ketchikan, I raised that question to, I think, Tom Coster, the AG's office, because I was concerned that the state staying out of the land exchange process, that a bill could come through and identify the land exchange along with the opening all at once. And he felt, it was his idea that would be a rare case that they would join the two together in one bill. But now I get the feeling that's a great possibility. What is your feeling? Do you think that it'll go?
Senator Jones, I'm not really in a position, I guess, to assess what the prospects are for the form that the ultimate legislation is going to take, and I don't think anybody even within the department is suggesting the form that would take at this point. I think our position is that we want to have these agreements signed and ready to go, and then it gives Congress the discretion to pursue whatever form of legislation it sees in the best interest of both the state and national Congress. And we simply are trying to put these things together in such a way that allows the flexibility for Congress to move in whatever direction it sees being most suitable.
I understand that, and I know that the department wouldn't try to influence legislation in any such, any way. But the report, if it came out, fairly positive along these lines, may have some influence. I understand that. But it's not that's not what you wish to do. But
yeah.
But I just wanted to point out that, I think the state needs to, more and more, needs to be back at the table because of that possibility. That bill coming out of Congress with both addressing both the opening and the land exchange all in one fell swoop, and the state will be on the outside.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Sturgulis.
If I could pursue a little bit your earlier questioning. John, we know, we see a little bit more clearly how the various parts of this are coming together, and we still have a lot of interest about when there might be some kind of action. Are you in a position at all to hazard a guess of whether it might be this Congress, this session, that seriously takes up that issue? Is it, at this point, are you able to give any indication what a priority it might have within, even say, this administration?
Senator Sturgulewski, it's very clear, I think, that as far as the Secretary is concerned, that the opening of the 1002 area is the first priority with the Department of Interior and with him personally. Beyond that, I'm not really in a position, I don't think, to represent or adequately represent what might happen beyond that. I think there will be a considerable effort made in that regard. But the prospects for ultimate legislation is anybody's guess, I guess, at this point. There are a number of opinions, and I think you've probably heard them all, and I'm not sure I can offer anything that would be any more helpful.
Senator Fahrenkamp.
John, you, in light of that last remark, as well as the isolation or segregation of the 1002 report, would you want to venture an opinion as to the isolation or segregation of our resolution, I think you heard my question of the Native corporations this morning, as to whether or not our resolution, first resolution, Congress should be clean or encompass the other facets of the things surrounding the opening of Anwar, like land trades, the 9 and 10, et cetera, et cetera.
Senator Fahrenkamp, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage, as you can imagine, in terms of making that sort of a recommendation, given the timing and all this and where the Secretary is. I'm not sure I'm in a very good position to advise you folks on that.
John, all you have to do is say tilt, and we understand.
I understand completely, but you have no hesitation in making the one issue, the opening of Anwar, a major issue, and then whether or not the addressing the lands issues or the lands trades will go with that issue has not been a decision, obviously, or at least if it is, it's not public, of the Interior. So I'm just, I thought there might be a reasoning behind that that you'd want to share with us. Okay, I'll drop it.
Well, I think I just elaborate a little bit further, Senator Fahrenkamp. Obviously, since the Secretary has not made a decision on the propriety of the land exchanges, I'm not in a position to represent what the Department's recommendation would be.
Very well done, John. Thank you.
We're trying.
Senator Zaroff,
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question here. In the event there that you reach an agreement with the regional corporations, and nothing happens in Congress for a period of time, how long are those agreements good for?
Senator, the timing on those is under negotiation now. There is a window after the signature and lacking congressional action during which the Native corporations can back out of the agreement with some cost. And that is subject to negotiation right now, how much of a window that's going to represent. I can say this, I think it will be somewhere between 4 to 6 or 7 years, something like that, where the Native corporations, absent congressional action, could simply decide not to pursue the exchanges. But there would be a certain amount of cost associated with that because of the cost of putting this together. The federal government, the way the contract is structured at this point, would not have that option. We would have to stay with it. After this trigger is reached, this time period is reached, subsequent to that point, either party could back out without any cost to either party. So there is consideration for that, but it's being negotiated, and the idea is that there will be some force of effect for a limited period of time during which we assume would be a reasonable period of time for within which Congress would act. But I don't think either party wants to be bound too long a period of time, obviously, if it looks like Congress isn't going to act.
Are you talking about monetary costs?
In terms of reimbursement?
Right.
Yes, sir, that would be correct. There would be some monetary costs if it was, I guess I would characterize it perhaps as a premature bailout. In other words, what we're trying to do is say, okay, we're going to sign an agreement. That signed agreement will have the force of effect for a certain period of years during which we would hope that Congress would act. If Congress doesn't act during that period of time, either party could back away from the agreement. If prior to that time the Native corporations wanted to bail out, they would have that opportunity, but there would be some costs associated with that.
And I guess maybe just a question I asked earlier there, trying to get the feeling of the mood back in Congress now. Is there a feeling there that something that could be worked out within the next 6 to 18 months or whatever it is, that there would be a feeling that something could go through on this Congress?
Senator Zaroff, I really don't have any feel for that. I'm sorry. I don't know. I've heard the same predictions you folks have, and I'm afraid I'm not any better judge of the adequacy of those predictions. I'm probably less of a judge than you folks are.
Well, I guess you're trying to get to the point there where you wonder how much wheel spinning you want to end up doing. You kind of feel that you're not going to get anywhere. How much effort do you really want to put on this particular one? We're looking at 120-day sessions, and we're really trying to do something to get some activity going as far as the state's concerned.
Well, Senator, a good share of the work is behind us, quite frankly, and what's left to be done, I'm not sure whether I could adequately characterize it or not, but at least from my personal perspective, I feel like probably 80% of the work is done in terms of the negotiation of the contracts and what those would ultimately look like. And then once you get into the congressional arena, obviously there's a big workload there. But
Senator Jones?
Chairman, John, once the land exchanges are negotiated with the Native corporation, did you like for the states to come in and say, hey, you know, we'd like to trade?
Senator Jones, I believe we spoke to this issue, and I believe Bob Gilmore did when he testified in Anchorage, I believe, on this issue. And basically, even after we've agreed to the terms and conditions of an exchange with the Native corporations, even if we had signed them, theoretically, until the time that Congress acts and there is, in fact, a leasing program, it appears as if there would be a window of opportunity. It's a question the question of timing becomes one of then from a state perspective of missing the opportunity to be on this first train that's pulling out of the station and missing the opportunity potentially to participate in the identification of these tracks on this in this first effort. But it's possible there could be a second train, and that train could include one participant, two participants, three participants. But I think there is a limit, obviously, to the number of trains depending on the amount of resources that might be involved in the exchange, and I think the Assistant Secretary has spoken to that issue and indicated that we weren't going to consume a majority of the subsurface resources through this process.
Otherwise, all we get is the best of what's left.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. You can continue with your observation. I guess there's no other questions. I've got two or three, but we'll wait to get down, and then we'll wrap. So, John, do you have an observation, or you want to...
Senator Coghill, I believe I covered several of those. There's just a couple that I might touch on. There was an indication that subsistence easements, and I put subsistence in quotes, were being successfully pursued on the part of all the Native corporations. There will not be, for example, a subsistence easement on the Kenai Peninsula. And the reason for that is that the Kenai is one refuge that does not have subsistence uses or subsistence uses as a primary purpose. And there are other rationales that I think you can probably all see for why we might not be granting a subsistence easement on the Kenai. I think the other thing that needs to be pointed out is that there is a cost associated with subsistence easements. So there will be a certain amount of discounting associated with the retention of a subsistence easement on the part of the Native corporations, and that's a negotiated discount that's built into the equation. There is consideration of what I refer to as a constraint policy. That came up again this morning. We're not certain the form that's ultimately going to take. I think there will be some form of constraint, and that could take one of two, as I see it, one of two forms. It would either take an aerial constraint in terms of before there's any tract identification, we simply indicate that certain areas are off limits for whatever reason. And secondly, it could be in the form of a percentage of any particular structure or what the geologists call a structural trend, since sometimes it's difficult to segregate one structure from another. But I think you will probably see some form of constraint ultimately built into the tract selection process. There was mention of the fact that Chalista had, I believe, offered a subsurface component, and it wasn't clear to me, or I don't recall exactly how that was characterized. There has been an offer made by Chalista Corporation for a subsurface component. We have not responded to that yet in a formal sense. It's being held in abeyance, and we're taking a look at it. I think I indicated previously to the subcommittee that right now there is no subsurface estate or subsurface interest that is a part of the exchange, and that still remains the case. One other point that I think might be helpful to clarify is that the terms and conditions of the present contract do not have any limitation in terms of the timing once the conveyance occurs. So if the agreements are signed and if Congress acts, and the Native corporations are free to pursue their interests to the limit that they choose to pursue them in a free market. So it becomes a matter of speculation as to how far they would choose to pursue them. I think our expectation is at a minimum they would pursue exploration in advance of a lease sale. But it's not totally impossible that they might not pursue. There would be no rationale or no cause for them not to pursue it as a result of the contract we're negotiating, that they could not go into a development and production phase absent a leasing program. But as a practical matter, I think the expectation is that there probably would be some form of exploration potentially in advance of a lease sale, but little movement in the way of a development or production scenario simply because of the amount of cost involved in developing the infrastructure. But there is no legal or contractual restraint on them pursuing their full enjoyment of those rights, which would be exploration, development, and production, all three phases.
Okay. I guess the only question that really needs to be cleared up is that before the first train leaves, why there's track selection, and that's when they open up the whole selection process, and you've gone through that, but just to make sure that everybody understands that
that process is still going on, and that process will not close until May?
or is that going to close next week? Or
no, Senator Coghill, I think we would simply continue to pursue our objective until we've reached it, and our objective at this point is to sign agreements as rapidly as possible.
And are you continually sending messages then back to the state to get back to the table because this process is going forward? Or is that a tilt?
Well, Senator Coghill, let's put it this way. I continue to have discussions with my friends on the state side about potential exchanges.
Right. Is there any other questions of John?
Just a quick question here. Since I was kind of on the outskirts of that Terror Lake, I had to hear the brunt of that. Were you familiar with that part at all?
No, sir, I really am not.
Where it was basically, the value was kind of prorated at 1 acre of refuge land for 20 acres outside the refuge. You carrying that formula through on this one as well?
No, sir. The valuation equation, if you will, is built on a different scenario or a different set of criteria in this instance. And if you'd like, I could spend a few minutes talking about the valuation process. I've done that in the past, but it's obviously an area of interest. Let me take the easy one first, and that is the valuation of the subsurface interests on the Arctic. Easy in terms of explanation, anyway. The subsurface interests up there are going to be valued based on the best available information and the best professional judgment of our subsurface managers, in this case the BLM, and Mr. Menge of BLM is here today if you care to discuss that with him in a little more detail. That value is not going to be negotiable. That value will be fixed and will be known as a part of the tract identification process. I don't know what those values are, and no one else does that I'm aware of in this room. And I won't know any more than Native corporations because of the separation of responsibilities and the way this thing is fixed. The valuation of inholdings, of the Native corporation inholdings that are being brought to the table, are a separate form of negotiation, and those negotiations are being conducted by Assistant Secretary Bill Horn personally, one-on-one with the Native corporations. And basically, those values are looking at four components. That valuation is composed of, it looks at fair market values. It looks at the public interest or public attributes that a particular piece of property brings with it and the environmental implications of that. It looks at transactional economies, in other words, the opportunity, the scale of this transaction, and it looks at management efficiencies. And what it will do, there will be an agreement in value reached there that takes into consideration those four criteria and hopefully represents both the best interests of the government and of the Native corporations, and in effect represents a negotiated price. But it's a price that's only a value to the extent that it buys something up on the Arctic, and that's the reason that I think you heard a certain amount of equivocation on the part of the Native corporations in their testimony this morning, is they don't really know what their inholdings is going to buy them until they get through tract identification. And if they don't like what that buys them, then they simply walk from the table and come back and talk to us another day. So I guess the point I'm making is that this is a willing seller, willing buyer kind of an arrangement, and nobody is forced into a position of accepting something that they're not willing to consider represents an equitable kind of a proposal on both sides. And I think when it's all said and done, if we don't have people that are happy on both sides of this equation in terms of the exchange, then we won't have an exchange, pure and simple.
When the exchange is made, and let's say everything goes along as planned, and then you find there that there may be some corporations that decide not to do anything in the reserve area up there, and they just not do anything for 100 years and decide then all of a sudden they want to do something?
No, sir. Not sure. If they remain a party to the agreement, theoretically that's true. If they remained a part of the agreement, they signed the agreements, and the agreements moved forward through Congress and there was congressional approval, then they could enjoy that interest any way they chose to pursue it. And we wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't force that equation. There is a limitation, though, in terms of the fee interest. And I can spend a little time going into that, but basically what it amounts to is there is a determinable fee that's built into this thing so that there is an outside limit, and that's being negotiated. It gets a little bit complicated, but if a corporation, say, for example, we were to sign agreements, Congress moved on this thing, there is some time in the future that their opportunity to pursue this would expire if they took no action, but it's sometime pretty far out, I can tell you that. So the idea is that if they move forward with the exchanges, they would want to realize some monetary benefit, and they would pursue the enjoyment of that interest within a reasonable time frame.
Okay.
Senator Bernkamp.
Mr. Chairman, I want to put John on the spot one more time, through the chair, if I may. John, would you care to comment, or is it a tilt, as to the charge on the part, or I guess that would be the term to use, of the administration that in consideration of some of the land trades that no leeway is made or given for the state claims to navigable waters and the navigable waters and stream bed issues, are any of those being addressed in the negotiations between as you work on the land trades?
Senator Bernkamp, those are issues that have surfaced, and there have been discussions with regard to that, and basically what it amounts to is, and I think Assistant Secretary Bill Horn's letter to Representative Cotton probably best represents what our position was on navigable waters and submerged lands, but in essence what it amounts to is both parties understand that there's certain risks associated with these exchanges in the event the state is successful in pursuing claims to submerged lands, and whether it be under navigable waters in some other form, and both parties, all the parties at the table, are willing to assume those risks. Is about the simplest way to express it at this point.
Thank you.
So that just gives us one more reason to be back at the table. Is there any other questions of John? If not, what we're going to do is that I've been requested for about a 10-minute break, and what we'll do is after that, why, there's been expression that we want to ask Gary Gustafson a couple questions, and we're going to open it up for public comment, and we're moving right along. So with that, I will take a 10-minute break.
Thank you.
We'll call the subcommittee on ANWR hearing back to order. We'll continue now with our required witnesses, and we've asked the state to come back to the table. But before we do that, we'd like to also, for the record, note that we have another troop from the Kodiak School here, and Mr. Keplinger has brought his junior high school, I imagine, students to listen and to watch this, and we're going to get you one of the preliminary reports. We only have the one here, but it's all marked up, and it's the office copy. So with that, we'll continue, and we have Mr. Gary Gustafson from the Division of Department of Natural Resources, State of Alaska, before us, and he was asked to be brought before us. Do you have Senator Sturgill?
Mr. Chairman, Gary, thank you for being here, and again, if we have a tilt question, you will tell me, but and I might explain to the students that there are certain things that, from a policy point, different individuals simply cannot make comment on them because of whom they represent, and there's certain information that they can't share with us at this time. But we're coming very close to the time that we take some action on a resolution, and you know the one that we have in now, which is basically, it's in the best interest of the state and the United States that we develop ANWR, and there are some environmental and local hire considerations that certainly need to be respected. How would you suggest that we might go about finding out what the administration most would like to see in a resolution? Are you prepared to be able to give us some guidance, just like we ask of you on a bill? We want to know the administration's position, and it's never much fun to do a lot of bloodletting and coming to consensus and then finding out, well, that's not the way someone wants to go. Do you have any, specifically the question would be, do you have any recommendations for us as to what a resolution should say that perhaps the administration would be interested in seeing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and to answer Senator Sturgill, I do have some suggestions, and I'd like to use this time to project that the resolution, in terms of being most responsive to the state of Alaska, might address some of the concerns expressed by the governor when he removed the state from the ANWR trade negotiations. First of all, and foremost in a lot of people's minds these days, of course, is the issue of revenue. The possible loss to the state of Alaska of a tremendous potential revenue source. Secondly, whether or not the land exchange component of the ANWR process is considered a disruptive or a constructive influence in opening the coastal plain. And third, that we all try to figure out a way that we can maximize benefits to the largest number of Alaskans. I'm talking about the state, I'm talking about Native corporations, industry, that we have labor addressed, that we have all the concerns that go into the state of Alaska addressed in a maximum fashion, that we make the benefits of opening the coastal plain as productive as possible to the most number of beneficiaries in the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then, Gary, what you're really saying is that we'd have to deal in a great deal of really depth and specificity. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Senator Strzelczuk, it's always difficult to figure out what Congress is going to do, and after all, any resolution or recommendation by this body, the Alaska State Legislature, is in the form, basically, of a recommendation to the U.S. Congress, which has the sole responsibility for opening the coastal plain and dealing with land exchanges. As you've heard in previous committee meetings, as well as this one today, that's a process that, very simply, we can only influence. And the degree to which we influence it is somewhat speculative. It's viewed right now as a national issue, not a parochial Alaskan issue, even though those of us in the state are foremostly concerned about its benefits or its detriments to the state of Alaska. Therefore, our ability to influence Congress and what Congress does in the future, I can only offer as something that we are only able to influence, not certainly to control. And I also don't know, like a number of others, how long this whole process is going to take.
Mr. Chairman, just as a final question, how do you anticipate that the administration, not the legislature, but the administration, will make its position known in some level of detail, other than broad public interest?
All right. I'd like to, briefly, if I might, I came here not to read any prepared text or anything like that, because I've done that previously. But on that question, I'd like to articulate a bit about the governor's ANWR advocacy program. And I take it that your question dealt more with the process of opening the coastal plain than it did specifically about land trades. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what happens from the administration? Where does the legislature, the administration, the public, where do we come together? That's what I think we're all looking for right now. I mean, we're part of the process. You're part of the process. If
right.
we don't get our stuff together, we're not going to win.
Right. Last Saturday, I had the opportunity to participate, as did the chairman, Senator Coghill, in an ANWR public policy forum for the Alaskans have to be viewed as a united house, not a divided house, in order to be most effective when we go to Congress. So with that in mind, the governor has launched an ANWR advocacy program that has a number of components. One of which the governor just finished hiring a staff person in Washington, D.C. to act as a state lobbyist to start being effective in the trenches in Washington, D.C. We're going to have a relatively modest yet important press and public relations component, and that will involve hiring a public relations firm to disseminate information and provide the kind of contact and interface that we need to have with the nation's press, particularly focusing on some of the key states' media outlets. We're also going to have a lobbyist firm hired, hopefully on a contractual basis here shortly, that will provide, again, an outreach of this process so that the state's concerns and involvement will be known. I find it interesting that, by and large, Congress is not very concerned about the state of Alaska. Maybe that surprises no one here. But in my travels back to Washington, D.C., it's been very evident that, number one, the majority of congressmen know very little about ANWR. Number two, they don't really care about the state of Alaska. They're more concerned about national energy perspectives and things that might strike or tickle the national consciousness. So what we got to do is convince them that this isn't just a state issue, that it's a national interest. It's a national energy interest of enormous dimensions. And get that message out. For an example, I thought the promotional brochure that ASRC prepared was that kind of sort of, it was a glossy media sort of information piece, but I think it was effective. And I think those of you who had seen it would tend to agree. We need to have state officials. We need to have other knowledgeable Alaskans out there knocking on doors, not only in Congress, but also throughout the other 49 states, carrying the message, Alaska's message and the national message, so that we can make our case and make it effectively. In summary, I think it's going to take exactly what you suggested, Senator Strzelczuk, and that is that Alaska has to be together, that we have to go in with a message, and that's why the governor has found this land trade issue to be particularly dissatisfactory in the sense that it's a divisive influence. And that's one of the reasons that I've articulated previously that he has chosen to remove the state from that process, because it was his belief, after having been back in Washington, D.C. personally, having talked to some of the senators and representatives on key congressional committees, I'm talking about people like Senator Johnston and Representative Miller, that the exchanges were not going to go anyplace. And in fact, in August of last year, 10 U.S. senators, 10% of the United States Senate, signed a letter to Secretary Hodel in which they said that the trades were a disruptive influence on the process of opening the coastal plain. It's that kind of feedback that the state administration has been very cognizant of. We feel that we've got to get the coastal plain opened and do it responsibly, that we'd like to get the state of Alaska rallied into a progressive program to do that, but the exchanges, as currently formulated, don't do that. And again, the governor has not closed the door on exchanges, just in their current format.
Senator Jones. Gary, you say that it's more of a national interest and that they're not, that Congress isn't interested in the state's interest. Well, it is of a national interest to develop the oil. And the other side of the equation on the land exchange thing is that it is the national interest to get the refuge lands back into the system, or they wouldn't even, the Department of Interior wouldn't be there. So there has to be some interest in the land exchange on the national level. And so it's going forward. They're putting something together. And we hear, you know, some interest that in the bill that will come out, chance it'll be an exchange section in the bill. So what benefit is it for the state to be sitting on the outside of this land exchange and saying, you know, it isn't to our best interest to be there, when really, I think it is, because those refuge lands are a national interest, and they are going, I think they're going to do some trading to get those refuge lands back, and the state might as well be a part of it. What is your feeling? Are those refuge lands just a state interest?
Well, with all due respect, Senator Jones, it's like the old story that you can play it any way you want to, really, and it's probably too early to play it anyway, but the way I see it is the Department of Interior, as evidenced by John Doble earlier, has said that the ANWR trade process is a very high priority. And I would assume that the rationale for that is, just as you suggested, that there are key components of the Alaskan National Refuge System they would like to see put into public ownership so that they can be protected from the threat of private development. However, the other side of that equation is that every large national environmental group, the kinds of people that you would think would jump onto that bandwagon, let's get these private lands out of the development threat and into the refuges, have they supported trades? No, they haven't. And frankly, you know, you can read Congress a lot of different ways. But I think to get this process through, it's going to take a whole bunch of contributing factors. It's probably going to take environmental groups, it's going to take the state, it's going to take the natives, it's going to take oil industry, it's going to take everybody working together, just like it's going to take everybody working together to open the coastal plain, quite likely. Anyway, my answer to your question is that I'm sure that that's a high acquisition priority of the Department of Interior. They wouldn't have gone as far as they have. But that is not necessarily shared by the national environmental groups. And again, in their current format, the state does not share that opinion. We want to, you know, we're interested in the national perspective too, but we're also very, very interested, foremost, in the state's perspective. And that perspective in this case means that in order to gain those national benefits, the state of Alaska is being asked to take a a cut in what conceivably could be a very substantial revenue source. And we got to wait and see how that plays out, how 90-10 plays out and so on, but I can stand before you or sit before you today and tell you that currently, under the 1920 Mineral Leasing Act, any oil and gas development in National Wildlife Refuge is subject to the 90-10 split for the state of Alaska. Now, Congress can change that. We've already had a couple of bills introduced to do that. But right now, that's what we've got, and we want to maintain it.
Senator Jones? Mr. Chairman, the 90-10 split, I don't believe it really has anything to do with land exchanges. I mean, whether the land is exchanged or not, we still can force the 90-10 split.
No, that's not the case at all. Any lands that are traded to the natives, the state loses every royalty and bonus income from. The only thing we would get would be severance taxes and corporate income taxes.
Understandable on what's exchanged with the native corporations. I don't have a problem with it. I happen to think that if we can put it in private hands, that's fine. Let the private corporation go ahead with some of that development up there. I don't see anything wrong with that. What's wrong with private shareholders having a stake in one of our resources? I see nothing wrong with that. The environmentalists I don't think they argue with the refuges going back into the national system. What they argue with is the opening of ANWR to oil development. I don't believe they're saying don't get the refuges back. My God, they're out there trying to lock up everything they can every day of the week. So that what they're against is opening ANWR to development. I just can't seem to be convinced that to the best of our interest as a state citizen to be sitting outside of that exchange. That you have not convinced me that we shouldn't be sitting there as a partner in this whole exchange with the native corporations as on their side and they on our side forcing the issue. I think that's the way to bond the native corporations and the state and also the unions. Let's get them to back some of this also. They're a strong movement in this country. I think we can do all of this, Gary, and still support that land exchange. I don't see the problem.
Well, Senator Jones.
Is that a state senator there? Question?
Yeah.
Well, no, that's an answer. His answer, I guess.
Do you wish to respond, Mr. Gustin?
Only very... very briefly, and I think I'll do it in the form of an illustration, if I might. Again, a lot of things can happen in the coastal plain, but let's just assume for a moment that Congress opens the coastal plain, and let's assume that land exchanges go through, and that native corporations get a portion of the coastal plain, and that the state of Alaska is not involved in those trades. What happens if a native corporation gets the only tract that has any oil? Now, you can say that's unlikely, and it probably is unlikely, but what we're doing here is we're betting on what potentially could be our replacement for Prudhoe Bay. That's our piggy bank, and we all know what that means, and it seems to us that you got to be absolutely sure what you're dealing with when you're dealing cards of those kinds of stakes. Now, again, that's one side of the spectrum, and you've got all kinds of degrees on what could happen, but native corporations all have industry partners. Their industry partners have varying degrees of knowledge. The industry partners will assist those corporations in making selections when it comes time to make selections. That's what they're there for. Therefore, it's conceivable that they're going to probably get some pretty favorable tracks based upon what is known. And again, frankly, I think anybody, whether you talk industry, the native corporations, the state, or the federal government, we'll all agree on one thing, and that is that not as much as is known in the coastal plain as could be known, as perhaps should be known. The seismic grid lines that were done in the winters of 83, 84, and 84, 85 are just very gross, and you've heard testimony on that. Our people tell us you could miss massive oil fields based upon those kinds of seismic grid lines. Therefore, it's a very suspect exercise that we're getting ourselves into.
Are you done? Senator Baron Camp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, you've confused me a great deal, especially today. In that I understood your response to Senator Sturzaluski's first question concerning first issue to face this committee, which is the type of resolution that can come out. I understood your answer to be rather of an all-encompassing type of resolution. And yet, you know, addressing the issues that the state is objecting to or feels that are important, and yet that would not be what I had understood to be the primary issue that the state felt there could be some forming a solidarity on, and that is opening Anwar, period. Are you now telling me that the administration would prefer a resolution that addressed all these issues rather than a so-called clean resolution?
No, I'm sorry if I confused you, because...
Well, that's the answer I got. What did you get?
The position of the administration, very simply, is first and foremost is that we would like to see the 1002 area opened to exploration and development, subject to reasonable environmental constraints, as we have articulated to the Department of Interior in our 1002 report comments. That is our paramount objective.
Okay, having read the responses to the 1002 report, at least what I've seen, I guess it's responsive, then you said that the grids on the seismic data in trying to determine that Native corporations, if, for instance, we were going to land swaps, that the grids were so big oil fields could be missed and somebody could get the best ones and the state would be left out. I can understand very well the 90-10 fears on any leases in those areas or any land swaps. And it seems to me if that type of thing was wanted on the part of the state, that we ought to be insisting that be there for land trades. Are we doing that?
I guess you confused me. I didn't understand that.
Okay, we'll drop it. I'll come back to that later then. Are you saying then that as we have only these large seismic grids and things that could be missed, that then we shouldn't do any drilling up there until the grids are smaller?
Oh, no.
Or until we have more information?
No, I wasn't suggesting that at all. If you open the coastal plain to mineral development, further exploration and development, under the current provisions in the Mineral Leasing Act, then the state gets 90% of any retained federal royalty and bonuses and so on. And it doesn't really matter what else happens because the state gets 90%. Parts of the fields could develop. There could be additional exploration. I'm not really sure what Congress is going to allow. But we've protected our position to get that 90%, and that's the most important thing. If you trade some or a number of tracts to Native corporations, then the Mineral Leasing Act does not apply because the Mineral Leasing Act only applies to public lands. Once lands are traded, they're in private ownership, and the federal government retains no royalty. The Native corporations get 100% interest in the oil and gas that would be traded to them. And all I'm suggesting is that there is enough information, and you've heard a great deal and body of it in your previous meetings, to lead us to the conclusion that the coastal plain should be opened. But what I'm raising when I'm talking about the size of the seismic grids is whether or not there is enough information for specific track selections for purposes of land exchanges, where you've got a bunch of different owners going in a checkerboard grid deciding who gets what where. And incidentally, these track sizes are only 2,560 acres each.
Sure.
Did you want to follow through, Senator Cunningham?
Well, just one more time to try to get the same response I've been trying to get from everybody else around here about the, whether a clean resolution or an all-encompassing resolution. What would your recommendation be there, Gary?
Well, the best recommendation I could give you, and to be totally consistent with the state's current position, both on the opening and the land trades, would be that the coastal plain be opened as soon as possible to exploration and development, subject to the Mineral Leasing Act.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturzaluski and then Senator Jones.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we're faced in the Senate with a position, and then obviously to try to get through the one in the House, and that's why we've been really zeroing in, trying to hear from different people what they would say. But I think am I correct that if you're speaking for the administration and you are sitting down and writing a resolution, it seems to me these are the things you would say, and I'd be interested to have your response. One, that you've hired a lobbyist, and I would assume that lobbyist is your lobbyist. It is not necessarily our lobbyist in the case that we have a problem. I mean, you're going to carry the administrative position. Number one, that you would open AMWAR. Number two, that you would hold out for the 90-10. Number three, that, and not necessarily in that order, that you would speak to the environmental concerns dealing with the pork calving area and such. And then four, simply by the fact that it follows the others, you would speak against the land phase. Is that correct?
That is correct. And the only thing I would add is that we would speak against land trades in their present format. Incidentally, there are a couple other things, too. Obviously, that you could throw into that mix to be more consistent with the governor's objective, at least, to maximize benefits. And I'm sure you've already considered a number of these, and that's provisions for local hire, if possible, those sorts of things.
But the only thing on the land trades, you say, at this time, and I suppose that says we're interested in revenue or potential revenue to the state. And do you then, or again, wearing the administration's hat, see that being accommodated by Congress as opposed to through the process of negotiation with the Department of Interior?
Well, it could happen either way, but I think any administration would prefer to attempt to influence it in the form that it had the most direct sort of participation role, and that would be through negotiation. Now, I should say that when we left the table, the third week in February, it was with the understanding that we had given it our best shot, that there were quite a number of concerns that the state of Alaska had, that the Department of Interior was unwilling to alter or acquiesce upon. That was certainly a part of the reason why the governor did what he did, along with the big pictures that I mentioned in the beginning, the revenue, the disruptive influence, and the fact that it didn't maximize benefits to all Alaskans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all, but I might say from my personal opinion, that's a crock.
Senator Jones.
To the Chair, Gary. Just one more time, I think I know your problem, but what do you see now as the problems with the format, the land exchange?
With the format of land exchanges?
Yeah, you say you have a problem with the format.
Well, I believe it was the last meeting in Ketchikan when I listed 9 concerns, and those are part of the record already.
Right.
I believe I can probably remember all 9 of them, but... they included the things like the subsistence easement, the fact that we had a concern, obviously, over revenue. Navigable waters has been mentioned already here once today. 7I, whether there was a 7I component in sharing. What the regulatory responsibilities were between the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and the regional director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The timing of the trades. Whether or not they should be executed before Congress opens the coastal plain. And then, in addition, I think we had a few others, in addition to timing, maximization of benefits, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, you say that the native corporations and oil companies are in bed together, or they know more than what the state knows, and so that puts the state at a disadvantage sitting down in the track selection process. Is that right?
I didn't say that.
Well, you say the state's at a disadvantage?
No, I say that we've got a varying level of comprehension or information between participants. And where we left again the trades the third week of February was that, as you know, each native corporation has one or more industry partners. And incidentally, when we're talking about oil companies, we shouldn't make the mistake of lumping all the oil companies in because not all the oil companies, as you heard earlier today, are a party to this exchange process. But those that are aligned with the various native corporations. And it is known that at least a couple of the corporations are aligned with an industry partner who has access to the Kickwell data. I'm not qualified to speak to how much of an advantage that may or may not be. But if you assume that it is an advantage, then some of the parties may have more information than others.
Well, then you say that they do have an advantage.
They may. I can't say that they do. I'm not qualified. They may.
All right. They may. But okay. Well, in the track selection process, Gary, the way I understand that, the way that goes is that the state, if we were in there, and if two of the selectors choose the same track, they negotiate it out. I mean, what would prevent us from, if we feel they have more information and are selecting better tracks, can't we select that same track then as we go along in the process and
We could, Senator, except that you have to play by the rules that the Department of Interior establishes. And unless something has changed in the past month, when the state last left the table, the conflict resolution mechanism was one of two vehicles. Either it would be competitive bidding, in which you just raise the price, of course, until one party gives, or the assistant secretary got to decide himself which process would be utilized. I think that may have changed just recently. And, excuse me, I need to correct myself on that. I think it did change in that the second mechanism was a lottery rather than having the assistant secretary arbitrarily choose. Let me correct that. So it's competitive bidding and lottery are the two mechanisms. And, of course, in lottery, depending upon how many parties are involved, you know how that falls out.
Senator, just a question. Gary, I guess I'm not real up on all this, and I'm not really privy to all of the previous meetings that we've had and previous testimony, but it seems to me that the state's been involved with this backyard ball game, and they've threatened to take third base and go home, but the game is still going on. I don't know, am I right or wrong?
Well, I haven't heard it characterized quite that way. But
well, I mean, isn't that basically you don't own the ball, you don't own the bat. Gloves are still there. I mean, people are still playing games.
We do know that the field's there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that if we're going to get any points out of this thing, we ought to be in the game, too. But how do you see this thing coming together? Do you see various phases of the whole thing, or what?
Well, Senator, first of all, you have to take a reading on whether or not you actually think the trades will go through. And obviously the state of Alaska has done that. And with all due respect, I believe that we have come to the conclusion that they aren't going to make it. And that they aren't going to make it for a bunch of reasons, and they may be political, they may be legal, but that they aren't going to make it. We like the outcome that has the coastal plain being opened, and preferably the Mineral Leasing Act applying so that the state gets 90%. And if Congress comes in and changes the 90% to 65 or 50%, that could well happen too. I don't know. But even that would be preferable to losing everything on the best tracks if, in fact, the native corporations were, by virtue of their information or luck or whatever, to obtain many of the best tracks.
It seems to me you've got two teams out there that are setting the ground rules right now as to what's going to be there, what isn't going to be there, and you got the state still in the dugout kind of looking and seeing what the heck's going on, and then after the game has started, you're going to come out there and want to get into it and say, hey, we want our piece of the action here, but the other two teams have already divided up the playing field, and they've already decided what's what, and they're not going to be real supportive of what you want out of the deal. And it seems like if you've got the whole league together out there, that at least you start looking at making all the concessions you want right at the beginning, and if you want the 90-10, that you certainly have a lot more going for you with three teams there instead of just two already having what they want and the other one not.
Well, see, we played this game in the preseason, And in the preseason process, we found out we didn't like it very well.
Maybe you better have been more cooperative. But I guess I'm just a little bit concerned, Mr. Chairman. I don't know exactly what's going here and what's going on. And then I'm a little bit...
What do you think right now?
Seems to me that we've got two fronts that we've got to work with on here. One is Congress and the other is the Department of Interior. And we can't be concentrating just doing everything with Congress. And I'm thinking in terms of the state right now. Trying to concentrate everything with Congress the way everything that I've been hearing right now is just by trying to beat our heads against a brick wall, but we ought to be working with the Department of Interior along with the other groups that have a specific interest with the Department of Interior at this time.
Yeah, let me speak to that just very briefly, and I think it was brought up this morning. There was a concern about, well, it's come up several times. The state ain't in there. How can we expect our interest to be upheld? Mr. Doble mentioned that he and I are in consultation weekly. Just last week, John Katz met in Washington, D.C. with Assistant Secretary Horn, had about a two-hour briefing on the status of the trades. We know what's going on. We know what the trades looked like when we left. They haven't changed all that much since we were there. The fact of the matter is that, again, we just found them inherently distasteful in that present format, and we were unsuccessful in our attempts to get them changed.
Senator Fahrenkamp and then Senator Lassen.
You had said that in the state's assessment, the trades aren't going to make it, I think was your words, in Congress. What's the state's assessment of opening Myanmar?
Well, that's the big question for everybody. We're optimistic. We hope it's going to happen. We're going to devote our energies to that purpose. I don't know when and exactly what format it's going to take. Nobody does.
Let's put it this way. If today Congress is asked to push the red or green buttons, what's your assessment of what would come out?
Well, my personal assessment is that it would be very difficult today. I think there's a whole bunch of work that has to take place. As I mentioned to some people earlier today, a lieutenant governor was back in D.C., talked about 50 congressmen, only a couple of them knew what Anwar was all about. I think that's indicative of Congress as a whole. So we got a long ways to go.
I might add to that, Mr. Chairman, in working with Council of Governments, most people never heard of Anwar, don't know what it is, and not sure they want to know what it is. But that's in various state legislators. However, we're starting to go through some of the legislatures now with what we call a clean resolution.
Senator Lassen.
Mr. Chair, my question along those same lines. Is it realistic to believe that Anwar will be opened if we have if we do not present a unified front on the issue? What are our chances of opening it then?
Well, if oil goes to $50 a barrel, it looks better all the time. But
that's not a very good answer.
Realistically, I said again, and as I did last Saturday in my presentation at Alaska Outdoor Council, that the state has to be together. And I can't stress that enough. And we're hopeful that that can be achieved.
Would the state be together, the legislature and the exchange people were together?
If the legislature and the exchange people were together?
If the legislature were to support the land exchanges and go forward to Congress with that position, what would happen to the state? Would that influence the governor's position?
I don't know. Ideally, Senator, it would be nice. This is one of those situations. It'd be real nice to turn back the clock and say, okay, let's put together a new process and let's get everybody on board and let's get them all working to the same objective.
Mr. Chairman, I think turning back the clock to the time that the state got out of the ballgame might be the proper place to go. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Lassen. That's good advice. Senator Jones.
Gary, you mentioned more information. What more information do you think is needed past or beyond the 1002 report from the Department of Interior and Secretary? What other studies? What other information?
Refresh my memory when I mentioned more information.
Well, you said before Senator Fahrenkamp asked a question about whether you thought that it should be opened or we had a chance or not. And you said, there's more information that needs to be out there.
Well, that I think what I was probably referring to is the fact that more information needs to go to Congress to get Congress educated about what ANWR is and what's at stake.
Mr. Chairman, that 1002 report is supposed to do that, isn't it?
Well,
it's supposed to put information out there in front of them?
I think it's supposed to provide factual information, but I think you'll also find that, number one, it hasn't even been delivered in its final fashion to Congress yet. And the vast majority of congressmen, I'm absolutely sure, I'd bet on it, haven't seen it. It's going to take a while for even when it comes out for that recommendation to sort of get some play and for people in Congress to get educated.
Mr. Chairman, again, I guess that you're correct, and the 1002 report is supposed to have all that information, and it will take a while, but that's going to be a large volume of information that I don't know what else they're going to need. Going to have everything there is to know about ANWR.
If I was a senator from New Jersey, I'd want to know how that was going to benefit, the opening of ANWR was going to benefit New Jersey. I think that's the kind of mindset that we have to deal with now.
Well, that takes lobbying.
That's right. And that's why we're getting our program underway.
That's why we need to be together with our congressional delegation, the governor, and the legislature. Native corporation, labor, all of them.
Thank you very, very much for I think that we covered many of the grounds that we'd covered before, but knew some new people at the table. And
thank you,
Mr. Appreciate your candidness. We are now going to open the our hearings to the public. We have two people signed up that wanted to be called up together, and that's Hank Pennington and Al Birch. Please come up and join our table, and we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come before us.
Okay, I want to welcome you to Kodiak. You got some good Kodiak sunshine out there. Al and I are up here as I'm chairman and Al's vice chairman of the Kodiak Island Borough OCS Advisory Council, and while not dealing with particular details of the ANWR proposals, we thought it would be worthwhile to pass on some of the experiences of Kodiak in the fairly recent offshore oil drilling that occurred in the Shelikof Strait. As you know, Kodiak's one of the major fishing ports in the country with a lot of concerns and a lot of issues, and walking through the process, we thought on behalf of the Kodiak Island Borough we could talk from the community perspective, which is going to be a bigger and bigger issue down the line as you develop the area. As the proposals to develop oil off Kodiak were laid out in the beginning, we had a lot of objections and a lot of problems, and Kodiak made the decision that if we stonewalled the whole process and just threw it all out because we didn't agree with what was going on, we'd be eliminated from the process of developing the configuration of the sales and what went on should a sale occur. And from that perspective, the Kodiak Island Borough developed a rough policy, if you will, that we weren't opposed to OCS development per se, but we wanted full partnership in the process of deciding when and how and what configuration the sales were to be conducted, should there be sales. And that community perspective is at the bottom of the big pyramid on the decision process, but in fact we were trying to change it from a pyramid into a partnership. As we went through the process of developing a lease sale, if you let me do that as opposed to developing an oil field, there were a lot of years we went through public hearings, review of drafts, and everything else as you're familiar with. And in retrospect, our biggest problem with oil development was with the process itself, of a community trying to participate in the proceedings. And once a decision was made to have a sale, competitive bids, bidding process was over, and we had Chevron to deal with, suddenly we weren't dealing with this big amorphous mass in which you had secrecy and everything else. We had somebody tangible to talk to. We had specific proposals to do very specific things. And once we got into that process, we can't say enough good about Chevron in particular, the company that was in, because they were willing to meet with us on specifics. And if nothing else, the local airlines profited from the number of trips Chevron made back and forth to Kodiak, because it seemed like every other day of the week there was somebody from Chevron here to meet with us and address these concerns. They were proposing to drill in rich fishing grounds during active fisheries, and in fact, on two occasions, there was gear damage, and restitution was made. Probably the most significant outcome of the whole process was that by participating as a partner from the beginning, Kodiak had a say all the way along the line. And in fact, I think the lease sale that occurred in Shalikov Strait is notable in that there were no lawsuits and no other legal actions from beginning to end. And when you're dealing with active, highly politicized fisheries in this community, that says a lot. And probably to summarize and then give Al a chance to talk, I'd like to endorse the Chevron in particular. I think they represent the whole oil industry. Endorse their ability and their willingness to work with communities and to address environmental concerns, so long as the concerns are expressed and the dialogue is maintained. And that's probably the only thing that kept us out of lawsuits, was we kept talking. Al, you probably got comments to add. Al is a manager of a draggers association, one of the prominent fishermen's associations I mentioned.
We started out in 1974 with Oil Sale 46, and it was the first time we became aware of oil, and our immediate reaction was, no way in hell. It ain't going to happen. We aren't going to let it happen. As Hank said, the borough supported us. We hired people to look over the proposals. Through some of the subcontractors, we had a chance to get out and see what was going on out there. We were taken out to the drill rigs 100 miles offshore out here, and had a chance to see how things were operating. Became more involved in the day-to-day stuff. We had the Kodiak hot seat, as we called it. As Hank said, the oil people came down, they sat on the hot seat. And what started out as fairly antagonistic, developed into a partnership. I was lucky that in my association I had a number of Texas fishermen who had come up from the Gulf and had worked around the oil companies. And they were very valuable to me, and I'd bounce the problems off them. And I said, what's the problem? The oil rigs are a good artificial reef. If you run into engine trouble or something, one of the tenders will tow you into the rig. You can get fresh water, run out of fuel, they'll stake you with enough fuel to get back. So we started into more of an agreement mode. Once we did get where we were dealing with just Chevron, then it became very good. Our concerns were listened to. Our fishermen were taken out on the geophysical rigs. Our fishermen were taken out into the Shelikov on the exploratory rig. The fishermen used that rig during the wintertime as a weather station. We'd call from town. If the weather was too rough, we wouldn't even leave town. But it's been a good process. I hope that something like that could be set up for Anwar. I do believe Anwar should be opened. It's lag time from exploratory to production is 8, 10, 12 years. It's something that's going to be very important for the state. Perdo Bay is starting downhill now. So I urge strongly that you do come together with some kind of a resolution that can get that area open. And I'd also be glad to answer any questions.
The committee have any questions of these gentlemen? Their statement was straightforward and very helpful.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Lass.
They find any oil?
Proprietary information.
But you said you were partners with them.
Yeah, that's still proprietary.
Partners on their money.
Is there any questions? Not Senator Fahrenkamp.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank the members of you two for coming up and explaining what happened with us. It's encouraging to hear that that fears can be put aside and problems can be solved in a way that opposite poles can come together, because it looks to me like we're going to have about four or five opposite poles trying to come together and trying to get a state position. So I must say you're the first word of real encouragement I've had today. And I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr.
It has worked very well with us. If you have people with an open mind that you can talk with, and they're willing to sit down and talk, you can pretty well overcome most of the problems.